Young, it's here and now. In a moment, a conversation with correspondent Bob Woodruff. He came back from Iraq with a brain injury and a mission to help troops get the same care he had. But first, the first congressional inquiry into misinformation from the battlefields in Iraq and Afghanistan opened with emotional testimony today.
My name is Kevin Tillman. 2 days ago, I marked the third anniversary of the death of my older brother, Pat Tillman, Spear, Afghanistan. To our family and friends, it was a devastating loss. To the nation, it was a moment of disorientation. To the military, it was a nightmare. But to others within the government, it appears to have been an opportunity.
Kevin Tillman accused the U.S. military of what he called deliberate and calculating lies, intentional falsehoods, fraud, and even criminal negligence about his brother's death, saying the cover-up of his brother's death by friendly fire came at a time when the war against terrorism was turning against the U.S. Also testifying today, former Army Private Jessica Lynch. We remember her rescue in 2003 was heralded in the first days of the war in Iraq. She was presented as a hero then, but told lawmakers today, the American people are capable of determining their own ideals of heroes. They don't need to be told elaborate tales. Margaret Talev of McClatchy Newspapers is covering today's hearing. She joins us from the Capitol. And Robin, first of all, let's start with Kevin Tillman. Kevin Tillman was an Army Ranger nearby when his brother died. I'm sorry, Margaret. Nearby when his brother died, he essentially said the military covered up his brother's death because they needed a good news story. But did he prove that that's what they did?
No, Robin. I mean, he hasn't proven anything yet. What he and his mother have done have come in and talked about what they've been able to uncover in the last 3 years as they've been demanding answers to more questions. But what they told the panel is, we don't have any paper trail, really. We're here to ask you to give us the proof for what we suspect has been happening.
There have been three previous Army investigations of Pat Tillman's death, one from the Defense Department Inspector General last month, which cited commanding generals and officers for making mistakes. What did Kevin Tillman say, if anything, about those investigations?
What he's been telling this panel today is that he doesn't believe that that it's simple as calling it a mistake, that when you patch the pieces of evidence together from conflicting stories about what happened to Pat Tillman in the early weeks to information that trickled out later about his clothing and notebooks being burned, about whether he had paddle marks on his chest from defibrillation that would have occurred, you know, an hour and a half after he had died, that none of it adds up, that none of it makes sense, and that they suspect that this went all the way up the chain of command.
And suspicion is one thing, but did we learn any more about what the White House or former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld knew about Pat Tillman's death?
No, I have to apologize. I'm right outside the hearing room. It's a bit loud.
That's okay.
There is a panel that is supposed to convene shortly that will include Department of Defense and Army officials that haven't testified yet. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that there's not a huge expectation that there'll be any major revelations today, mm-hmm. but that the idea is to begin a congressional investigation today, to begin to put the stuff on the record and to compel testimony from other people if they don't get the answers they're seeking today.
Meanwhile, Jessica Lynch, at the time of her rescue after she was captured, it was said by the Pentagon that she fired her weapon until her gun was empty. That turned out not to be true. She said she's been trying to correct misinformation about her 2003 capture ever since. She specifically said today her appearance was not politically motivated, still supports the troops. Let's listen.
At my parents' home in Work County, West Virginia, it was understaged by media, all repeating the story of the little girl Rambo from the hills of West Virginia who went down fighting. It was not true. I have repeatedly said when asked that if the stories about me helped inspire our troops and rally a nation, then perhaps there was some good. However, I'm still confused as to why they chose to lie and try to make me a legend when the real heroes of my fellow soldiers that day were legendary.
So, Margaret Talev, in the few seconds we have, wrap this up for us. What does Committee Chair Henry Waxman intend to do with this?
With Jessica Lynch?
With all of this?
Pardon me?
With all of this blistering testimony?
Well, I think Chairman Waxman intends to begin compiling a dossier and comparing one person's testimony against the next and calling more officials in. Where it all ends is very much remains to be seen. He has about a dozen investigations of the military and the Bush administration and the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars, mm-hmm. all going simultaneously. But the testimony today has certainly been very dramatic and emotional.
Margaret Talev of McClatchy Newspapers, again covering today's congressional hearings, looking into the death of Pat Tillman and the rescue of Jessica Lynch. Margaret, thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
A suicide car bomb killed 9 U.S. paratroopers and wounded 20 in Baghdad yesterday, the worst attack on American ground forces in Iraq in more than a year. The number of casualties in the war continues to mount. But Bob Woodruff says not all of them get the medical care and attention he did, and that's something he wants to change. Bob was a longtime foreign correspondent for ABC, just appointed the new co-anchor of ABC News when he and his cameraman Doug Vogt were hit by a roadside bomb while embedded with American and Iraqi troops outside Baghdad January 29, 2006. Doug was not as severely injured. Bob's wife, Lee, the mother of their 4 young children, got the call that Bob had survived the blast but suffered a traumatic brain injury, or TBI, his head literally blown apart. He was treated in the field, airlifted to Germany, then flown back to the U.S. He woke from a long coma to face months of painful rehab. Life had changed in an instant, which is also the title of the couple's new book. And Lee and Bob Woodruff join us with more. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. You look great. Do people tell you that?
Yeah, some do on television, you know. But I got to tell you, it's just so quickly it's come back. That's the miracle.
It is amazing. First of all, I want to ask. You know, many people know you. Your head was shattered, and I'm sorry to do this, but I'm wondering if other people do as well. You are a very handsome man. Do you find people now staring at you even more than maybe they did in the past to see what they can see in your head of what happened?
Well, I think they know. They've seen some of the pictures, you know, from what happened to my head before. You know, part of the bones off the top of my head on the side of my left side were taken off. It was removed about 14 centimeters. And so that's something you have a question about. Like, well,
yeah,
that thing that was cut out before, what happened? Well, this piece of plastic has now been put back on there.
Is that the acrylic plate that they put in your head? What's it called?
Cranioplasty.
That's the one I'm thinking of. In the pictures in the book, and you share pictures that are very difficult to look at, of your head almost collapsed on one side. So is the plate now raising that back up?
Yeah, now it's back now.
Yeah.
I mean, this is radio, so it's hard to see it. But I mean, if you're listening to this, go feel up your left part, side of your head, right above your eye on the left side, right where your head is there, and you can imagine that's what it is, right above the ear, all the way up to the center of the top of the head.
And again,
that was gone.
This bomb that hit you was packed with pebbles and rocks, and we see a CAT scan picture in the book. These were embedded in your head. We can see them in the CAT scan. Are they still working their way out or no?
There's a couple that are still popping out.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, there's one in his ear right now and one in his eyelid, too, that I'm waiting to come out.
You see those in? There's one actually underneath my jaw down here, underneath, like right down by my neck. There's another piece about an inch wide that's still in there. That's never going to come out because they're worried about taking it out. It might cut my tongue.
How does one become accustomed to this, Lee, first? I mean, just working
my
their
husband
way.
Has rocks in his head. I thought that we'd be able to use that phrase relatively frequently, and it would be true. I remember the first time we were in the hospital, he was maybe awake for 3 days, and his brother Mike and I were sort of inspecting his face, and we saw a really sharp pebble poking out of his skin, and so we sort of squeezed it like a zit, for lack of a better term, and it popped right out. We both kind of looked at each other and said, geez, you know, how many years is this going to go on? Because there were so many rocks in his face. In fact, some of it's just purely dirt that was blasted into his face, and the doctors described that basically as a tattoo. That will probably never come up to the surface. It's the same as having a dye kind of shot into your derma.
You've suddenly been thrust into a world many people are familiar with, many not. We thought today maybe you could help us learn about this world of the post-brain injury. Have you been meeting Americans who have said to you, I have to tell you about someone I know or my own head injury?
Oh, absolutely. I think, first of all, we get a war here where we never expected this to be a war that would lead to so many traumatic brain injuries. This is because of the IEDs that now are used by the enemy to blow up around those military guys that are involved in this war. It's probably the number one kind of injury that we've got. But the thing that people don't understand as well, which is the traumatic brain injury, about 1.4 million a year in this country get some kind of traumatic brain injury, whether it's you get you're in a car crash and you slam your head against the front of the car, or you get hit by a baseball bat, or you fall down, or you get beaten up, and this is happening all over the country.
Football players have been
football,
the most recent story.
That's exactly right.
Big
in football
sports.
Too.
Right.
And so as people start to learn more about what's happening in this country on traumatic brain injuries, at the same time they're seeing so many coming in this war versus previous wars because the miracles that have been brought out by the medical guys.
But the problem is that the medical care in the States doesn't match that. Lee, you're nodding yes.
I'm nodding because so many medical developments have come from battlefield medicine, essentially. But the disconnect really comes with a head injury. It's not like a broken bone, you know, it's not like repairing something. This is probably a lifelong journey, at least a number of years for many people. It's funny because your first comment to Bob was, "You look great." And in the early days after Bob would wake up and people would see him, I would just wince when I would hear that because I wanted to scream at them and say, but how does he sound? You know, he looks great, but this is why they call them the walking wounded. You know, they may look terrific and normal on the outside, but inside it's terribly messed up.
The other thing we hear about head injury is that many people who have these head or brain injuries, you know, they're aware that they're not where they were.
No, I feel the same way. I'm not back to where I was before. The doctors, you know, will always tell everybody you're not going to be 100% back. That doesn't mean that you might be 90%. You might be more, or even out of that 10% that you're missing, maybe you got something else interesting in your life that is something different completely. But you're not going to be exactly the same.
What do you feel the part of you that may not be back? What do you?
Well, there's still moments where I can't remember the names of things.
I was wondering, you were just talking before, and you were talking about war, and I heard a little pause, and then you said military guys, and I wondered if you were looking
for that. I couldn't even think of the word military. Yeah, there's things like that. I don't know, earlier yesterday, I couldn't remember the word Lebanon, you know, a place that, you know, I've been around in my life, and I can't remember some of these. There's something really strange is I couldn't remember, for example, how to say Blair, you know, the prime minister of England. But I could say Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran. You know, why could I remember one but not the other? I still don't know to this day, and I couldn't remember some of my brother's names.
Lee, share some of the moments. Some of it is, you know, if it weren't your husband dying for him to have the right word, it's delightful. He would say sleep puffers instead of pajamas, or he gave the kids cuddles instead of cookies.
When we got to the point where he was coming out with cuddles and sleep puffers and breast explosions
breast explosions.
Well, this was a friend he'd seen when he went back to Detroit, and he came back and he had all these pictures that he'd taken, and he was showing them to me, and he looked at me when he was showing this one of his friend's pictures, and he said, "You know, I think, Lee, that she's had a breast explosion." And I said, "You know what, honey, that's not the right word, but that's actually a bit more apt, I would think, and I think I'm going to start using it." So there was the Verizon man who became the Viagra man at one point in time. So those were all funny. And by that point in time, in the beginning, Bob made no sense. He would often make up so many words that he was speaking gibberish. And so by the time we got to sleep puffers and cuddles and breast explosions, I was feeling really lucky. And I was seeing this pretty rapid progression in his head.
Lee Woodruff, she and her husband Bob are now working with the Brain Injury Association to help troops injured in war. We'll have more about that. And later, a phone call to Vietnam as a friend there remembers another journalist, the late David Halberstam. Back after the break. Here now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Back with more from Lee and Bob Woodruff. Bob suffered a brain injury after being hit by a rock-filled IED while covering the war in Iraq for ABC last year. His cameraman, Doug Vogt, was less seriously injured. Bob's recovery has been nothing short of miraculous. Bob, you say you were lucky in that a rock that entered your neck stopped 1 millimeter short of a major artery. Rocks also missed your tongue and your eyes. You had the best doctors and nurses. ABC hired corporate jets. Doctors here in the States were well aware of how closely you were being watched. You write in your book about feeling guilty about the gold standard care that you received.
There's multiple aspects of this I feel guilty. Yes, part of the guilt is that I had this company, ABC News, that was actually paying for my family paying for their airplanes and stuff to fly down and see me, my friends and my brothers. But the other thing that I felt guilty is the fact that I had done this to my family and that they were suffering through this and helping me.
You guys are brutally honest about that in the book. She got mad at you, you know, that you had done this to them, by sticking your head up through the hatch, trying to get that extra shot in the Humvee, and that's why you were more severely injured than anyone else in the Humvee.
I did have those feelings. I felt like, you know, you survived all this stuff. You just got this plum job that, you know, is going to allow you to continue to do the kind of reporting you want. Why were you taking that, you know, extra chance? And, you know, in Bob's mind, Doug was up there shooting. He was going to go stand up there and be next to him, was going to leave him out on the top. They'd done this a million times. The road had been swept for an IED 5 minutes before. It was supposed to be an example of a safe road. This was supposed to be a feel-good story about what the military was doing. It would have been so disingenuous to try to present a portrait of a marriage. I mean, we already look, I'm sure, nauseatingly like from the outside, this perfect family. And we're not. There is no perfect family. And it would have done a huge disservice to anybody who's been down the road with a head injury or any of the military families to not portray this like it really is.
Yeah.
It's hideous at moments.
Well, I'm wondering too, Bob Woodruff, if, you know, hear Lee saying, why'd you have to do that? And there were other times when you said, why did you have to go to Afghanistan? Why did you have to? I mean, you started your career, you were actually teaching English in China, and the Tiananmen Square was unfolding, and you just threw yourself into the story and volunteered with a news division there, and that's how you pretty much got started. You obviously have that bug. But I'm wondering if part of why you stuck your head out the hatch or, you know, traveled to all these war zones is that you have these movie star looks, and did you feel this need to sort of, you started to shake your head no, but did you feel this need to, you know, sort of prove even more what a real reporter you were? And then, of course, the irony is that your looks, your face is what, you know, was injured.
I don't think I would have treated this any differently if this was radio. I mean, this is, if you want to go see something's happening, you've got to come out of the top and look around and see it. Not only that, you've got guys that are actually Iraq military guys who are actually out, sticking out of the top, and you got your cameraman out there who's also up there shooting pictures around. For you to stay down below, that's also another thing. Doesn't really make any sense for you to be there at all. And I wanted to see how the U.S. was handing over power to some of these Iraqi militaries that they did. And that's why I was in the Iraqi vehicle.
Right. We should say you're the Iraqi soldier that was up top, he lost his hand.
Yeah.
So what do you do now, Bob Woodruff? I mean, do you turn on the TV? Do you watch, you know, the other guys and gal, Katie Couric? Do you watch the nightly news? You write that you feel blessed just to be alive, and I believe that, but is there a part of you that turns it on sometimes and says, that's what I was supposed to be doing?
You know, I mean, so obviously, of course, sometimes I think, oh, how did this last just 27 days officially that I got this one job that, you know, wasn't really nice and honorable when I was chosen for it? But, you know, maybe something happened here. You know, maybe this was to change me and to do something else, not only to try to help the other military that go into what I did and to what extent I can do it is great. The other thing is to go back to journalism, which is what I've always liked from the very beginning. What I really liked going out was reporting and being out in the middle of the street or in the building or in this country or around the world in other countries. And that's what I've always liked. I'm going to continue to do that now.
You're going to try to go back?
I'm going to go back. I'm going to go around the country, and I want to go overseas.
Lee, how do you feel about that? Because, you know, once a head injury, you got to protect that head.
Yeah, I mean, Bob's had to modify his life a little bit. He's supposed to not be playing basketball over at his health club, but I think he has been. I need him to, you know, be the person he was in terms of having the career that he had and the autonomy for it. That was the hardest part, I think, was being responsible for somebody during the caregiving period.
And how do you gauge things now, Bob? Are you conscious of, okay, how many words am I going to remember? How much more am I going to, are you gauging yourself now?
Yeah, well, you know, what the doctors say is that generally the recovery is sometime between 1.5 years to 2 years.
Right.
That's generally what they've said for all of the history. But there's also a lot of doctors who say, listen, we don't know. This could actually go significantly longer than that. So I think I'm going to keep getting better. Hopefully there's going to be some moment, though, when that really levels off, and I don't have that. But maybe I could go back and even do some anchoring and use words sometimes that are the wrong ones, but I got a reason for it now, and I got an excuse I didn't have before, so maybe that's possible.
Well, you've now established a fund, the Bob Woodruff Family Fund for Traumatic Brain Injury, and it's administered by the Brain Injury Association. This was once the Head Injury Foundation, based in Framingham, Massachusetts. What do you want to see happen, Bob?
I think if people start to learn more about this, they'll realize that soldiers and Marines that have been in this war that are injured are not getting quite as much help on recovering as they should be.
Here in the Massachusetts area, I know this organization is going to start a billboard campaign, putting up billboards to let returning vets know when they are going home and behaving erratically, having headaches, that in fact they might have a head injury.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That's terrific.
Well, that's a terrific idea.
Yeah.
That's great. Because a lot of times, a lot of these guys were being completely misdiagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, when in fact it was just disorientation or inability to put it together or problems with executive function, organizing the day. They sent most of these guys right back to the field, and they would get in car accidents. They would, you know, make bad decisions about things and hurt themselves. And then finally, you know, 3 years down the road, they began to understand that maybe blast injuries were not just ones where people had, you know, cracked skulls or bleeding wounds, that many of these just happened internally, hence the term walking wounded. Mm.
Bob and Lee Woodruff, their book is In an Instant. I want to thank you both so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us here.
And to learn more about their foundation, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, still to come, Cong Trang was David Halberstam's guide in Vietnam, but as you'll see, David was Cong's guide as well. That's still to come, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. A committee appointed by the board of the World Bank is investigating whether President Paul Wolfowitz abused his position in approving a high-paying promotion for his girlfriend, who also worked for the bank. In an editorial this week, the Financial Times called for him to step down, and a group of former senior bank officials also urged him to resign in a letter to the paper. Wolfowitz is promising changes in his leadership style and has hired prominent defense lawyer Bob Bennett to represent him. John Cassidy recently profiled Wolfowitz in the New Yorker magazine. John, a discontent with Wolfowitz started before this flap over his girlfriend, but I want to start there. Her name is Shaha Ali Riza. She's a British national from a Libyan family. Wolfowitz acknowledged their relationship when he took over. She ultimately was transferred to the State Department with big pay raises. Now, that's ruffling feathers as well, isn't it?
Well, the whole thing is ruffling feathers, but one of the aspects which has caused most controversy is that after she left, she was given a pay raise of about $50,000 and then another subsequent pay raise of 8%, which was roughly twice what other people in similar positions within the bank were received.
Yeah, I'm making about $190,000+ at the State Department, which is more than Condoleezza Rice makes.
She's still paid by the World Bank, so she's on a World Bank salary, and people of the World Bank tend to be very highly paid.
But I do want to clarify something. Obviously, there's a concern because Paul Wolfowitz engineered her move to the State Department. He says in his defense that it's because he knew that it was against World Bank rules to have her there and no one else moved her. But in your writing, he actually initially asked for her to be able to stay and possibly work with him at times.
As I was told, when Wolfowitz arrived, he initially wanted Shah Ali Riza to work with him, possibly on Middle Eastern projects, but was told by the board's ethics committee that that wasn't possible because it would violate one of the bank's rules. Everybody agrees that there were then various discussions, the upshot of which was that Shah Ali Riza was transferred to the State Department. The actual day-by-day, minute-by-minute account of how that happened hasn't really come out yet.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about discontent with Paul Wolfowitz before this issue blew up. Many know Paul Wolfowitz is known as a neoconservative and one of the architects of the war, the one who famously said 3 weeks before the invasion, "I'm reasonably certain that Iraqis will greet us as liberators." He does not accept the neoconservative label. But when he was appointed, were people feeling this was a political move?
Yeah, obviously at the bank, you know, there was a lot of outrage. The bank is largely staffed by non-Americans, and there was actually one internal survey which showed that about 90% of the people at the bank opposed his nomination. But I think it's a bit too simple to draw a conclusion from that they're just trying to get rid of him because of Iraq. He's been there for almost 2 years, and a lot of things have happened since then, including his anti-corruption campaign. Mm. It's not just a simple Iraq story.
Right, and as you write, there's an irony because he really does seem to care about the world's poor. He used to be a registered Democrat. Christopher Hitchens calls him a bleeding heart, saying he has the instincts of a liberal Democrat on everything except national security. Give us an example of an incident that was criticized, and tell us why.
Well, I think his big mistake, and I don't know if he'd admit this, but certainly from my perspective, I think his biggest mistake was bringing in a sort of small coterie of Republicans, two of whom were associated with the Iraq War, with him to the World Bank. I think if he'd have stood up at the very beginning and said, okay, that was my last job at the Pentagon, this is a completely different job, he might have done pretty well. But instead he brought a couple of people, one from the Pentagon and one from the White House with him, and they've basically been running the bank for the last 2 years. Of course, that caused a lot of resentment within the bank, which is staffed by people who've worked there for decades, and it really got him off on the wrong foot. What it did, it produced a lot of enemies within the bank who were looking for some excuse to bring him down, and, you know, he's finally provided it with this Shah Ali Reza stuff.
Under World Bank Articles of Agreement, it's prohibited from interfering in politics, as you write. Can you give us an example of where he maybe cut off funds to a country and that was seen as political?
Kazakhstan was one example. They threw the American out of their military bases in the spring of 2005, and in September of 2005, Wolfowitz cut off funding. There were a couple of ex-French colonies in Africa, Chad and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which also had their funds cut off. That was, some people in the bank saw that as a sort of slap in the face to the French.
Chad was using some of the money from the World Bank not to fund anti-poverty projects, but to buy arms. Chad explained that they needed the arms because they were suddenly defending against the conflict in Sudan, which had spilled across its borders. And Wolfowitz cut off the funding, the bank lending to Chad.
Right.
Some would say that that would be Wolfowitz doing what he was also charged with doing, which is maybe cutting out corruption or misuse of World Bank funds.
That's certainly true. Wolfowitz had a strong defense in a lot of these cases. The Chad example is a particularly good one because the government had actually signed an agreement with the bank about how to manage the proceeds of an oil pipeline which the bank had helped to finance. The Chad government then broke that agreement, so legally Wolfowitz had every right to cut off the bank funding. Sure, this is not a black and white story, and he had a lot of defenders inside the bank on that incident and on others. That's why, as they say, it wasn't as if he was going to be thrown out until this came up. Some people thought he was doing a good job.
Well, but as you write, there were people who worried, what his intention was. And you make an interesting comparison between Paul Wolfowitz and a previous president of the World Bank, Robert McNamara, who went to the World Bank in a way to make up for Vietnam, whereas Wolfowitz, not so. I mean, I'm reading into the headline on your story. It's the next crusade.
He certainly saw this attempt to reduce corruption in the Third World, especially in Africa, as a sort of crusade. He was sort of messianic about it. So, yeah, there were elements of a crusade in this, to be sure, but it doesn't mean he was just following on from Iraq. Although, as you say, some people in the bank did think that, especially seeing as he tried to set up a bank office in Baghdad and tried to expand bank funding in Iraq. That certainly turned some people off.
The Financial Times editorial says Paul Wolfowitz's presidency at the World Bank is over. Whether he is fired or even if he tries to stay, I mean, there's just he can't function. Do you agree?
I'm afraid it seems to have come to that. The problem is that he doesn't really have any supporters left outside the White House. The way the bank works, he's already alienated most of the staff, and almost all the senior staffers are now calling on him to resign. Fortunately for him, traditionally the president of the U.S. has picked the World Bank president, so he might be able to cling on a while longer as long as he retains Bush's support. But I think what the FT is saying is that that wouldn't really be a bank presidency. He can't really run the bank. He's facing a civil war there, basically, at this stage. So even if he stays, he'll only be there in name rather than in power.
John Cassidy's look at World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz appeared earlier this month in the New Yorker magazine, and John sort of unleashed all the controversy over Paul Wolfowitz and his girlfriend. But interestingly, in your article, it doesn't even appear till halfway through.
What happened was, I found out some information about Shah Ali Reza, and we have a policy at the New Yorker of fact-checking all our information. So before we went to press, we put the stuff that I'd learned to the World Bank and to Paul Wolfowitz's press people. And then, lo and behold, a couple of days before the magazine was coming out, this information was leaked to the Washington Post. Whether it was by Wolfowitz or not, I don't know. But things have been going downhill ever since for Wolfowitz.
Well, some would say so, but I'm wondering if you didn't think, darn, why didn't I put that up higher?
The way we write in New Yorker, things are written as stories. It's not a newspaper. We hope that everybody reads all the way through. And, the fact was it was some pretty damaging information, and it was in there. That's the important thing.
John Cassidy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And still ahead today, remembering David Halberstam, you're listening to Here and Now. If New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg gets his way, motorists who drive in parts of Manhattan will have to pay a congestion fee. Bloomberg floated the idea on Sunday, Earth Day, as one of a number of proposals to cut down on greenhouse gases and improve the city's air quality. Well, many New Yorkers took it in stride.
I think it's not a bad idea if it cuts down on greenhouse gases and whatnot, you know?
I think it's excessive when, you know, you consider the cost of parking, and I think there are probably other better solutions to limit traffic in the city.
The car is a hindrance in New York. There's no reason for it. We've got adequate public transportation. If I have to schlep a piano up to Times Square, so be it, then I'll pay the dues.
Beth Furtick has been covering the story for WNYC in New York. Beth, first of all, what does Mayor Bloomberg have in mind?
The mayor's trying to reduce the amount of traffic that goes into the busiest parts of Manhattan, which is south of 86th Street. So what he's proposing to do is charge drivers an $8 fee when they enter that zone of Manhattan, and trucks would be charged $21 for the day. It would only be in a place from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and you would subtract the cost of any tolls you paid. So, for example, if you took a bridge or a tunnel that charges about $5 a day, you would subtract that from the $8 fee, so the net increase would be about $3. But there are many New Yorkers who don't take paid tolls or bridges or tunnels to get into the city. They take some of the free bridges. And so for them, this would be certainly an added surcharge.
And we understand that there would be cameras that would record license plate numbers and charge an account or bill the driver. So it sounds like there's, you know, efforting involved here, paperwork and bureaucracy layered on it.
This is modeled after the system in London, where they charge about $20 a day for drivers to enter the most congested parts of London. And there they installed a system where you could pay in advance, or they have cameras that capture your license plates and they bill you and you have to pay within a certain period.
Okay. And we know that the mayor has an apartment in London, so this caught his fancy. What has he said about the reason for it?
Well, the mayor says there's many reasons. One thing, the air is obviously dirty. It could be a lot cleaner. And New York City's population is growing by an expected 1 million more people by the year 2030, when we would have a population of 9 million. And the New York City Partnership, the big business group in the city, says that congestion is costing the city a lot of money, $13 billion a year in lost revenues because of the time people spend in traffic. So there's lots of reasons from an environmental and health perspective why the mayor would want to do this. Here he is himself explaining it on Sunday.
The question is not whether we want to pay, but how do we want to pay? With an increased asthma rate, with more greenhouse gases, wasted time, lost business, and higher prices? Or do we charge a modest fee to encourage more people to take mass transit?
So, Beth Furtick, what's been the reaction to the mayor's call?
We have representatives from what we call the outer boroughs, Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, the Bronx, who are saying we don't want this to be a tax on the working class of New York. However, there's the business group that's for this. There are a lot of environmentalists that support this. There are organized labor unions who support this. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. There are lots of political leaders who are coming out against it, but there are also many who are sort of putting their finger in the wind and seeing what's going to happen, because there are a lot of benefits in the mayor's overall 2030 plan for improving sustainability, which includes mostly increasing mass transit options. So I think people are waiting to see what the mayor is proposing to do to help them get into the city cheaper and faster before they come out against this. But there's definitely going to be a lot of tensions from the restaurant industry, the truckers, the theater district, people who run parking garages, who are going to be very upset about anything that's going to make it harder for people to take cars into Manhattan.
Well, and I can just see a cigarette smoking, donut eating truck driver saying, you know, first the ban on smoking, then on trans fats. Now this rate increase. This has been a mayor who's been very proactive.
Yes, he's not afraid of taking the lead. He's a very wealthy businessman, and he feels like he has nothing to lose. He's only got 2 years left in office, and he says New York City should be the first real 21st century green city, and I want to take the lead. And he even got videotaped endorsements from California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, British Prime Minister Tony Blair. And so he's putting himself out there, and we'll see if this will catch on the way that the smoking ban.
Beth Furtick, reporter for WNYC in New York City. Beth, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll take a quick minute break, then a phone call to Vietnam to remember David Halberstam. That's ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Last night, I had the sad task of emailing my friend Kong in Vietnam to tell him that journalist David Halberstam had been killed in a car accident in California. After David Halberstam was a 25-year-old reporter for The New York Times, one of the first critics of the Vietnam War, or as Kong calls it, the American War. After he won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage and penned the classic The Best and the Brightest, Halberstam went back to Vietnam in 1999, and Kong became his guide. Kong was also my guide on a trip a few years ago. We reached him this morning at his home near a railroad station. When we called, he'd already set up an altar in honor of the American journalist he so revered.
So in front of me is the photo of David, his wife Jean, and me, taken at Dien Bien Phu on 18th May 1999.
He had come to Vietnam for an anniversary, right?
Yeah, for the 45th anniversary of the Dien Bien Phu battle. He brought with him the book Hell in a Small Place, written by his friends, Bernard Faure, because it is like a memorial trip to his friends who wrote about the street without joy, about the Vietnam War and Hell in a Small Place. And later he, that means Bernard Faure, get killed in Vietnam, I think, around 1972. He stepped on the mine or something.
Yes, this is Bernard Faure.
Yeah, the French-American.
Was he emotional on that trip?
Oh, yes, but quiet. And he wanted to read the book right on the former battlefields. And then he got the rose given to him by the lady on the rose field, keep in the book as a bookmark.
He brought Hell in a Small Place because he wanted to read it in Vietnam, and someone gave him a rose?
Yeah, because of the former battlefields at Dien Bien Phu, the last battle of French in the Vietnam War. Now it is a rose field. People grow rose on the battlefields. The lady working on the rose field gave him a rose, and he read the book in 3 days and night, right on the site of the battlefields, and then he used the rose as the bookmark for the book. And after he finished the book and he signed the book and he gave it to me, then now I still keep it as a keepsake. We had a very nice and long talk on that day. I took him to the French bunker of the headquarters of French, and I also took him to the bunker of General Yap. General Yap is 95 years old, so that generation now feel still alive.
General Yap, spelled G-A-P.
General Yap, the architecture of the Vietnam War. And then by chance, I took him to the pagoda in Hanoi, and this is just a luck or chance. He met again the Buddhist monk who informed him and his friends, Malcolm Brown, a photographer, during the American War in June 1963, come to the corner of the street in Saigon. At that time, that day, that corner, something happened. And then that is the immolation of the Buddhist monk in Saigon in 1963.
Ah, so you took David Halberstam to a pagoda where he met the monk who 25 years earlier had told David, then a reporter, that another monk was going to set himself on fire in Saigon. Then David told the world that story. That's amazing that you had that coincidence meeting with David at the pagoda.
Right.
Were you aware of David Halberstam's writings when he came in 1999? Did you know about his books?
I knew about his book, but normally people often say the masterpiece are for people to praise, but not many people to read it, you know? Like we mentioned the book like War and Peace by Tolstoy. So we say, you know the book? We say, I know. But no one read it. So after I met him, I read a lot. And then he sent me more. And one of his small book, on one very hot day, he told at the back of the book he liked that book best.
On one very hot day?
Yeah, one very hot day. He say, it is small, like a stillborn child, but he liked it best. he said that is real about Vietnam War. Not many people know about the book, and I have one copy sent to me by him.
What is it about?
It is about the first time the American advisor working in the Mekong Delta, beginning of the war. He predicted American could not win that war.
One
very hot day.
One very hot day.
Yeah, so not so famous, but he said, like the father who has many children, that is his favorite child. Yes. I think he has enough of writings on the Vietnam War. Some books he sent to me after, later, mainly on baseball. It's not good. It's out of place in Vietnam because we don't have a baseball. I have no idea about baseball. I don't know any rules of baseball. But I like the new one about the firemen on New York on the 9/11.
Yes.
Yeah, he also sent me that book.
Where would you place David Halberstam? What is his meaning to you? He was your friend, but...
I like his writing because it is clear. He quote a lot. So when I read his books, like the source of information, reading his book, it is like the roll of films rewind in my mind.
A roll of film rewinding in your mind.
Rewind in my mind. So it helped me a lot. When American came in Vietnam in 1965, I was 11 years old. So when the Vietnam War ended, I was 21. And a lot of information, a lot of details, a lot of names, location, place, I'm not clear. So when I get older and I read more of his writing, so I enjoy more. So now I have his photo, his wife Jean, and me.
Well, Kong, I'm so sorry. I know.
Accident, and I think this is the International Week on the Traffic Accident, and he died right on that week.
You're kidding. It's National Car Accident Week in Vietnam.
Yeah, you should look up in your news. Look it up.
I believe
And he died right in that week.
What were your thoughts when you heard that David had died?
I sit quiet, and now I try to get everything I have with him, his book, and then I take it out and start to read again, to meet him again in some way.
Well, Kong, I just have to tell you one thing that he and I used to talk about, and this makes me very sad, is that he was so looking forward to being your guide if you could ever come to America, which you said you wanted to do.
Yeah, I know. So now, if you have any writings or any articles on him, so please cut it cut off from the magazine or newspaper and send to me.
Yeah.
Very much appreciate. Okay?
Okay,
Kong. Because here I don't have much news on his death.
Yeah. Okay, Kong. I'm sorry this is why we're talking, but I'm so glad to hear from you, and I'm sorry for the loss of your friend.
Yeah, so that's life.
Okay.
Stay in touch. Thanks.
I will. Translator Kong Trang in Vietnam, remembering his friend and journalist David Halberstam, who was killed in a car accident yesterday in California. David Halberstam was 73. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.